newspaper men meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspaper men meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspaper men meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about ethical decision making in newsrooms and where we look at some of the issues confronting the modern media. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, here with my colleagues, a couple of veteran editors, and an aggressive young reporter in our midst. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, is here. Barbara Lombardo, who was executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record in Troy. And we're joined today by Raga Justin, who is Albany correspondent for Bloomberg Business. How you doing, Raga?
I'm well. Thank you, Rex.
You're still churning it out.
Yes, at the productive rate at about 2 to 3 stories per week.
There you go. That's pretty good. And now, Barbara, at the Saratogian, that wouldn't have quite met the necessity.
She would not have survived in our paper for 5 minutes. You have to churn out a story every 5 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Go. Yeah. It is interesting, you know, and this is one of the dynamics that you face in a smaller news organization where you have a broad geographic reach, that your impulse to have your staff do deep reporting smacks hard up against the need to actually fill the pages.
Well, you would try to assign people strategically. So you might have a reporter who's assigned to a longer-term story, and they might not be turning in anything that day, or they might be turning in some simple things that you can knock off in a day, but at the same time, they're working on a longer-term project for part of the day. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to find that balance.
Of course, we're talking about the difficulties in a time of relative plenty.
Right, that
newsrooms
would have been maybe when there were 5 reporters instead of 2.
Yeah, a brand new study just out this past week finds that the number of local journalists in the United States has fallen by 81% since 2002. That is, the number of local journalists per 100,000 residents, now 7.8 full-time local journalists per 100,000, used to be roughly 40 toward the beginning of this century. Interestingly, by the way, the states with the highest proportion include Vermont. Vermont tops the list with 19.1 local journalists per 100,000.
I did a State House fellowship a couple of years ago, and Vermont actually has a pretty interesting one of those nonprofit newsroom models that's sort of trying to re-energize the state of local journalism in the state. And, you know, this is like the New Jersey Monitor, the Texas Tribune, the New York Focus, as I think we've discussed before. So I think Vermont's obviously benefiting from that, but it's interesting.
Vermont Dicker is in that case, right?
I believe so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are actually nonprofits are this emerging ecosystem, but not meeting the local needs specifically. Judy, you're being uncharacteristically quiet.
Well, you know, I'm reminded of back in the day when you would have a lot of reporters in the newsroom and they would be competing with each other to get top play, to make sure who would be on the top of the front page. And you don't have that so much anymore because you just want anything will do, you know, and your stories will get in no matter what. It probably does the same thing for TV news, radio news, or even online, who gets to be the top of the website. And so you don't even have that internal competition that creates the need for really good stories or a really good enterprise. And so that's one of the things you lose. I mean, lose so much when you lose local reporters, but definitely that's one of the issues. The nonprofit model works well for the big stories, you're right, but it doesn't do so well for covering the school board meeting, for covering the contract about awarding, you know, who's going to pave the dirt road, or the issue about should we even be paving dirt roads. So I think that's lost. And getting that back, I'm more and more resigned to the fact that we're not going to get that back.
Well, I hear from, you know, from colleagues at the LCA about their early days when they were at a local newspaper and how fun it was because you were surrounded by other folks your exact same age and everyone. It was almost sort of you're going to work with your friends. You know, you're competing with your friends, but you're also going to work with your friends. Not that I don't go to work with my friends now, but But I do think the culture seems to have changed, you know, even at the Times Union when I was there. There weren't nearly probably as many folks as there would have been, both in the bureau and in the main newsroom, as there would have been 10, 20, 30 years ago. Yeah, I don't know. There's that sort of camaraderie that I think also seems to be missing, which I think would be a driving force for many young journalists who are leaving J school and saying, where do I go? Do I want to go to a small town in Missouri? Maybe if I know that there's, you know, 15 other early 20-year-olds who are going to be hanging
15.
Out with me.
Yeah, it's the collaboration and the support network that's not there. That, you know, the one reporter who's sitting next to you may say, oh, you should try to call this person or here's this number. That's often missing, especially nowadays you see so many reporters working remotely. So much has changed.
That's true. And it also comes into play when you're talking about the editors and the people with the experienced reporters who might be a few years older than you and the editors, without being in a newsroom to work together, which is the case in more and more places now, you don't benefit from their mentorship, from their experience. There's a lack of leadership, and it plays negatively into the results of what they write about.
Since the nonprofit, emerging nonprofit news ecosystem depends very heavily upon philanthropy, there are a lot of, in fact, individual philanthropy increasingly. There are a lot of foundations that have put a lot of money into newsrooms like New York Focus, like Vermont Digger, and so on. But increasingly, you're looking for major gifts. And the problem is those major gifts are not going to support journalism in places like the small towns of Saratoga and Washington County, New York. And that may depend upon individual journalists who go out and do their own thing, basically, which is why the creator network of Substack is kind of a good thing, right? Those journalists can emerge if they look at journalism as kind of a side gig. Does that make sense?
If you can afford a side gig for the long term. So yes, Substack has been a tremendous outlet for experienced and talented journalists of all age and different levels of experience to reach an audience. People leaving the Washington Post with grand amount of experience are successful. You, Rex, are successful, I think, on Substack.
But it's a side gig for me, you know.
That for most people, isn't that the case right now, that they're enjoying what they're doing and then realizing that, can I turn this into a way of life with affordability in the forefront is a big question mark.
If you start with your own base, for example, the guy who used to be the editor of the Washington Post Book World now has his own Substack, but he immediately, within the span of just a few weeks, amassed about 40,000 subscribers. Now, most of us didn't have that kind of immediate success in
building.
Were
they paid subscribers? That was unclear
to me. Well, he's getting enough to support himself. That's a good thing, right? So that's quite remarkable.
I think there's also something interesting here about people who are able to jump on trends or sort of that lower hanging fruit in terms of stories on Substack. You can go in deeply on an issue that might not have gained like an editor's attention. Like there's a threshold, I think, for an editor at an established news outlet to say, yes, that is a story because we have this many people who care about it, or, you know, the statistics sort of bear out the reporting of that story. On Substack, it's just, if it's just you, it's your own editorial decision. There are plenty of things I want to write about all the time, but I don't think my outlet necessarily cares about it.
Right. And the people who are consuming news nowadays are going to be more open to sources like the Substack writers. They're not turning automatically to, you know, what does the New York Times and the Washington Post have to say?
Well, that is interesting. People are, speaking of studies that are out, Reuters has an annual study, digital news report, and they found that while people are turning toward outlets that they even know to be untrustworthy, social media and video networks like YouTube, they don't trust them, but they're still turning to them increasingly. So it sort of is playing out against a backdrop of society in which we don't trust anything. We're just cynical in general. And I don't know how journalism fares in that kind of an environment where something that is based upon trust, upon the value of information is if it's real. The value of journalism is if you're giving people trustworthy information. But people seem to care less about trust than they do about either entertainment or simply confirmation.
You know, I know we talk a lot about the fact that institutions have lost trust, or people have lost trust in institutions. But when it comes to reading Substacks or even newsletters, a lot of times I trust something that I know has come from an institution that I have come to, over time, to have considered to have credibility. So because I get flooded with newsletters, I get flooded with alerts about Substacks, and I'll be honest, I'm reading about 15 or 20% of them. And the ones I tend to open and read are the ones that I trust more because they have come from an established institution.
Or ones that have found a very particular niche.
Correct.
That mainstream media isn't covering, right? Yeah. I do think it's heartening, though, to see people engage with Substack and to engage with Substackers. I mean, the bar is low, but I'm glad people are reading. I'm just happy.
Here, here.
We have information that's getting put out there and people who are consuming it. Because it doesn't always feel like that, right? So,
but you're writing for an informed public. When the people who turn, Raga, to your platform, to Bloomberg Business, are presumably people who've come to trust that brand. That is a strong brand that over time people have learned presents credible information. You're lucky because you don't have to worry so much that what you write is going to be immediately disbelieved, in part because I guess Bloomberg isn't as much of a political target
right.
as other entities are in the eyes, particularly of the president and his ilk.
And yet people like Raga do face challenges because to be a credible reporter, you have to be able to develop sources. And I know you are gifted in doing that, so I'm not worried about
you. She means I gab a lot.
You reach out to people, you gain their trust, you earn trust by staying on top of possible sources and demonstrating with your writing that you're balanced.
Talk about that a bit. Talk about building sources, because you came into the Capitol as a newcomer. How long ago? When did you arrive
in
the Capitol?
Almost 4 years ago now.
Has it been now?
Yeah.
How do you build a source network with if you're a young reporter who doesn't know anybody in the community at this point?
It's a good question. I think it was just sort of a series of happy accidents. And I had the benefit of an excellent office location. I worked for the Times Union's Capitol Bureau, and they have a really prime office right off of the Capitol, or the hallway in between the Senate and the Assembly Chambers, which, if you know, it's sort of the main thoroughfare for all the state lawmakers and lobbyists and advocates who parade around the Capitol every single day. So, you know, leaving your door open really gets you a lot of results. You just sort of look around and see if people are willing to chat. And most of the time they are. That's what they're there to do, is talk to the press. And I mean, I found that just being really, really open-minded, especially when you're young, you can come in and just say, I don't know anything. You know, like, I really do not know anything. So whatever you're telling me, make sure it's good. And I'm going to listen to it and take it and run with it. And I think people appreciate that, you know, that they want to be able to talk about things they're passionate about. And they want to be able to do it with somebody who has the power of the pen and know that their you know, viewpoints are going to be accurately represented to the extent that I was capable. It's also just enjoying, yeah, the dynamics at play there. It's people are really, really interesting at the state capitol. They've got a lot of interesting things to talk about, and they do it in really fascinating ways. I mean, the personalities there are just, as they are in many political places, like, just so interesting. So I don't know. I don't know if it's just being like wide-eyed and naive, but I really think it's just that openness to learning and really telling people, I'm not from here. So you got to just, you know, help me, fill me in, help me on this.
I was really taken by a piece that I read in Columbia Journalism Review of four reporters who cover the companies, basically one company, one beat, like someone who covers Disney, somebody who covers SpaceX, and so on. And each of these four reporters talked about building sources. And it was the old-fashioned, what I consider the basic old-fashioned source building. One of them said, you go to happy hours, you meet people for coffee. Another said coffee and drinks and events. To do face-to-face conversations, reaching out to people, does that still happen in the state capitol?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think you just get so much farther with the source in person than you do on the phone. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Now I'm glad we have phones. I'm glad that I can pick up the phone and call people in New York City, for example, so I don't have to keep going down to New York City to try to, you know, source down there. But man, it's just like, it's a different kind of interpersonal connection when you can just ask them to meet you at the Capitol Dunkin' for a quick coffee.
Yeah, it's showing up, I think. It's showing that you're there, that you're interested, that you'll stay till the end of the hearing, that you're available in the hallway to talk afterwards. It's being in unusual places. And the other, so we're talking about working with politicians or people in government, but also good sources come from everyday people too. And that includes getting out, joining the local softball league, or going to farmers markets and being part of the community. Cultivating a network of friends that's more than just reporters.
You know, I'd love to hear y'all's thoughts on this, because I sometimes struggle with this idea of embedding yourself in a community to the point where your sources could become your friends. I wonder if there's the line starts to get blurred at some point.
Oh, yes, and it's a great danger. But you know,
danger.
Beware having to report on your friends, but that does happen. I was struck as I remember being a young reporter on Long Island, and I was at a dinner party, and a guy I met who owned a shipyard, a boatyard, I mean, where people would put up their boats during the winter, you know, and they would launch from there. And he said to me, "Oh, I'm one of Bob Kessler's people." And Bob Kessler was a senior reporter in our newsroom. And I said, what do you mean? He said, "Well, you know, Bob comes around every few weeks and we hang out." Mm. And I thought, how interesting. This reporter built a source network just by figuring out who hears things. The owner of a boatyard would just be chatting with everybody. And I really actually took a lesson. You talk about young reporters learning from the environment of having senior reporters around them. This is a guy who would simply go around to different businesses and hang out with people to see what they were hearing, what was going on in their neighborhood.
It's interesting to me that that guy said that to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but there's a line. I think that if they invite you to their wedding, or that's the line. If you're going to their wedding, they're too much of a friend and you shouldn't write about them. I mean, not that people usually invite reporters to weddings, but sources shouldn't be your friends, is what I'm saying. I mean, not real friends.
Right.
I mean, your real friends you invite for holidays and for events. They can be acquaintances, but I don't think they're friends.
I found in my years at the Saratogian, where I started as a reporter and stayed through various iterations, that my friends tended to be people who were not in the business. I did have some that were in the business, you know, within the newsroom, but they weren't people that I covered, and so that made life easier.
And you lived in a small town, which
Saratoga's smallish,
big to me,
smallish.
Yeah, big compared to where you live, right?
Right.
I had a friend who ran a really fine nonprofit that actually did some business at the state legislature, and he complained to me once that he said, "You know, it does me no good to have you as my friend because you never write about us." And it was true. I mean, I would always have to avoid this, and you do. You find out that it actually affects your friendships.
And it goes even beyond that. You don't have to be a friend to get to know and maybe like certain people, and you know their families, and maybe your kids are on the same little league team. So you shop, you know, you run into them at the Price Chopper supermarket. So you see people, and when you have to write something critical about them, which, you know, happens, you do have kind of a sinking feeling in your stomach, because you're going to write something that's... Then you're not friends anymore.
Right.
You're not friendly anymore. You're not going to be friends, but you might have been friendly, and then you could just say, we're going to try to be.
This is just business.
It's
just business.
That, as we've discussed on this program before, the loss of that local connection is one of the reasons that we've lost some of the trust in journalism. This Reuters study that I mentioned earlier has found that globally, trust in the reported news has dropped to 37%, the lowest since they ever started measuring it in 2015. In the U.S., it's even lower. It's 25%. That is generally trust in what is reported by news media. So I wonder, as we've discussed, if one of the factors causing that is this diminishment of the local news ecosystem, so that nobody knows a reporter, nobody has a reason to trust
them. I remember an excellent education reporter at the Saratogian who left for a communications job instead and just said, "I couldn't stand just going to the grocery store and people knowing I was the school reporter and your pictures in the paper, and they would just be ragging on her." She goes, "I don't like being out front, and I don't like being the target for criticism."
I think we've all, three editors, have felt that here a lot.
Sometimes the police were involved.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, it's kind of like hip to be against the media. It's like, everybody says it. It's like the conventional wisdom. Oh, yeah, that we can't trust the media. I think it's something that the media itself sometimes perpetuates. And so I want people to be contrary about this, you know. Trust your media.
It's cool. Yeah. It's cool to listen to your local radio station. Cool. It's cool to read your local paper.
About that? If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith, here with Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and Raga Justin. We are offering you some thoughts on the journalism in our time. And if you have your views, media@wamc.org is how we get email. And we got a couple of interesting letters.
No.
Yeah, we did. Terry, a retired journalist, actually sent us a topic. And he also said, I love the Media Project, and I've grabbed the podcast every week for almost 20 years. How about that? He's now down in Texas, and he even when he winters and he listens
we
to us.
We should give him a loyalty badge or something like
we
they do
have
on
loyalty
Wordle
badges.
And
let's talk about that. I'm a media project. Yeah, I'm a media projector, we could say. I'm a projectile. Anyway, Terry sends off a piece from Dan Kennedy, who's a terrific media critic in the Boston area, now teaching at Northeastern University, longtime writer on media issues in the Phoenix and Boston and then in the Globe. And Dan Kennedy reported... Terry notes that the Rhode Island Attorney General's office has a novel interpretation of the state's public records law. If a suspect is arrested but not charged, then information about the arrest is not subject to public records law. They can conceal it. It's kind of absurd, isn't it?
It's beyond absurd. It's a terrible way of covering up the wrongdoings, whether they're intentional or mistaken, of the police departments. It doesn't make any sense, and it's dangerous.
Is there any element here, though, to the, I mean, you know, if you're arrested mistakenly, it's like the mugshot debate that I know we get into. I mean, is it worth it to put out the details of someone's personal, you know, an incident that happened that could be very embarrassing for some people, and then to have that sort of recorded in a police blotter?
Sure, you don't have to put that person's name in the paper. You don't even have to put their address in the paper. But there are instances, and I think that was cited in one of the concerns that was raised in the stories that he, information that that writer sent us, was that you can have police going to a place that's not even in their jurisdiction, harassing somebody, snagging them, bringing them into detention, and then not doing any charges. So now that there's no charges, so there's no record of the thing that they did. That's the troubling part.
Right. Right, I can see the envision the defense being that people are innocent until, you know, they're convicted. But that's totally not the point. The point is we need have an open judicial system, and once we start closing it down, then we have, you know, secret courts, and you don't know what's going to happen. Accountability relies on people knowing what's happening.
And the issue here isn't that the information isn't being made public, it's that it's not even foilable, right?
Right.
mean, that's, I guess that's where the distinction
is. It's concealed by the cops rather than being judiciously withheld by the media.
Sure.
It's an interesting thing. But this notion of openness.
This is the state of Massachusetts, is that correct?
That is correct.
Wow.
No, I'm sorry, that's the state of Rhode Island.
Oh, state of Rhode Island.
Uh huh. Yeah. So.
Does that make more sense to you? Everyone said, oh, sure, sure, yeah, right.
Look, I mean, Iraq is a former Texan, so, you know, we don't expect good government in every place.
I will take that, and I will swallow it down.
Okay, very
well,
good.
Well, it's reminiscent to me of the position that has been unsuccessfully put forward, that the police departments don't have to make public their information about cases involving, say, police excessive use of force or other investigations. If there was nothing justified found, if there was no justification for penalizing the officers involved, then they decided that they didn't have to make that whole thing public. And that had been challenged in court. And
there's a lot of question about the availability of information, too, about economic development funds. For example, there is a legislation that has just been introduced to open economic local development corporations. Those are the nonprofit corps that are created to promote economic development for municipalities. It turns out that that information is not foilable. And there's proposal in the state legislature just introduced, I guess, for the next session, right, Raga, that would require local governments to make this available. Because how do you know who is behind an economic development that's going on in your community if the documentation is secret?
Judy, you've been all over this for a while.
Well, I used to cover economic development, too, and even when it is foilable, they will use the provision of a company secret. They can't withhold. They can't release that. Even when they're using government funds, they won't identify the involved, you know, the company behind the proposed development. It's always been a huge issue. When does the next legislative session start?
Next January. Oh, jeez. We got a while.
But you reported about LLCs, limited liability corps.
Yeah. Right, and an effort to make whoever was behind LLCs available to the public, because right now you just put, like, you know, a street name and put LLC behind it, and you don't know who the people are behind the organization. And there was an effort for far greater transparency on that passed the legislature, but it was vetoed by the governor. So the business council would argue that, you know, to protect the privacy of the businesses involved. And I'm sure that's the issue that's going to be raised with this economic development corps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Issue too. Yep, yep. I mean, you've got these alphabet soups of economic development corps, agencies, LLCs, and, you know, the idea is people are working behind the scenes, and you don't know who they are, what their motivations are. At least the public doesn't know, and reporters don't know.
Well, that's why we are lucky to have the number of young working journalists that we do have, and why we need them, and why we're out of time today, because we've been talking about all these interesting issues. That's it for this week's Media Project. Raga Justin, Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith. And we are grateful to you folks for joining us at Media Project. Thanks to the producer of this program, David Gustina. We hope you join us again next week for the Media Project.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith. Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to the Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.